Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. And welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering a special rescue made by the Sandy Pines Wildlife Center.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
In a cat carrier, an animal that looks like a cross between a squirrel and a raccoon, but unlike anything native to Canada, looks grumpy. He certainly sounds grumpy, and rightfully so. He's over 3,000 kilometers away from home, and he didn't exactly buy a ticket. Sandy Pines Wildlife Center in Napanee recently welcomed an unexpected guest last month, whose journey is still unfolding. The story began after receiving a call from a manufacturer reporting a strange animal found in a shipping container. Sue Meach, director of Sandy Pines, recounts the unusual call they received on the evening of June 16th.
We got a call from some people in Belleville that worked at an auto parts store. They said that they had a Mexican raccoon in a bin, and it had been there for a day, and they put some water in, but they didn't know what to do with it.
Sandy Pines volunteer Greg Oosting was sent to investigate the next day. What he found was certainly not a raccoon, but needed help nonetheless.
I said, be prepared for what you see. I'm really not sure what this is, but we need to help the animal. Anyway, he got there and he said, well, this isn't a raccoon, but I'm going to catch it anyway. And it's going to die if it stays in here. So he was able to trap it. And then it was brought into us by a volunteer.
Once at the center, staff quickly identified the visitor as a caco mussel, a small nocturnal mammal native to Central America, characterized by its dark-ringed tail.
It's a very small mammal. It's only weighs less than a kilogram. So it's very small, about half the size of a cat, maybe a six-month-old kitten. And it has a long tail with beautiful gray and white stripes, or black and white stripes, actually, all the way up. At first, we were told it was a lemur, but when we did our homework and started looking it up online, we realized that it couldn't be a lemur because lemurs come from Africa. So we did a bit of research and discovered that there was a similar species in South America or Central America, and it was commonly known as a ringtail, but the technical name is a caco mussel. So it arrived, and at least we knew what we were getting, and we were prepared somewhere for him. They like trees to climb, so we had a barn stall set up with trees in it, branches in it that have been donated by very generous people, and trim their trees and bring branches in for our animals. And we set up a nice little den in there for him, and in he went. Apparently, the company in Belleville makes headlights for vehicles, and they pack up the headlights in sea cans and send them to Mexico. Mexico then sends back the empty sea can, and somehow this little guy, I can see how he's so small, if he'd gotten into the corner of a really big sea can in the dark, when you looked in, you wouldn't spot him right away.
While the stowaway was frightened, it was coping well under the unusual circumstances. The question now was how to return it home, or at the very least, to a safe environment.
So then it was the dilemma of what is the legal process for handling a situation like this. I have not, well, we did have this happen once with a bird. We had an albatross here many years ago that was not indigenous to Canada. So, but that was with Canadian Wildlife Services that do the avian species. So I reached out to the Ministry of Natural Resources, and who I'm a custodian, I have a license under their authority, and they said, well, it wasn't their department, called the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. They deal with animals crossing the border, apparently, whether they're exotics or food animals that are coming in. Anyway, they laughed when I called them and said, well, it's funny that you should call us, because we got a call from Belleville and they said to bring the animal to you and call you. So I was going round in circles here.
Meet began reaching out for guidance and suggestions. Eventually, she connected with Lee Parker, zoo director at Little Rays Nature Center, an exotic animal rescue located in Ottawa.
But I have a friend who's a vet in Ottawa, and she had told me that she works with exotics. So I explained to her that we have this caca missile, and we were quite happy to give him temporary accommodation, but obviously he needed something more than we could give him, maybe even try to get him back to Mexico. Anyway, she contacted me back and said, Little Rays has a nature center in Ottawa, and she's the veterinarian in charge there. And she checks all the animals as a volunteer. And she thought that would be the best place for him while we figured out a solution for this little guy. So I contacted Lee at the nature center, and he said that this was an unusual case, and they usually seem to get calls about reptiles and snakes, but he would be very happy to help. So he even said that they would come and pick up the animal, which was a great help because this is such a busy time for us. Anyway, he came and we had him all packed up, his bags packed and everything, and off he went.
While reptiles or amphibians sometimes slip into Canada, this case involving a mammal is a less common occurrence, according to Parker.
So with mammals in Canada, I mean, I've been in Canada for 17 years, going on 18 years, and we often get smaller animals like reptiles and amphibians come through, and they often come through either in fruit or flowers and things like that, which is a little bit, I mean, it's not, you don't get it every month or so on, but I mean, we do hear it, and there's often probably a lot of them that don't even survive because they often put chillers on the flowers or the fruit and stuff, and food goes into cold storage and things like that, and a lot of these animals probably won't survive. But for mammals, in the time that I've been at Little Rays, this is our first one that I'd heard of coming through like this, but I'm sure it's not the only case of it.
The caco missile was transferred to Little Rays Nature Center just before the long weekend. Now safely housed at Little Rays, work is being done to determine its origin and what next steps can be taken.
So really the process that we have when something like this comes in, when I got the call from Susan, I mean, Susan does a lot of rescue for native species. And when you have something that's exotic coming in or from another country, you have to be cautious about cross-contamination, especially if you're having animals going back into the wild. So she reached out to me saying, would Little Rays be able to take this animal on so that it had a place to go, and then we could either try and figure out a way to get it back to where it came from, or if not that, and it couldn't leave Canada, then where would we be able to find a forever home for this animal should it need to be there? So the steps that have happened right now is that I've gone through the CFIA, which is Canadian Food Inspection Agency. They deal with balls as well as food and things like into Canada. And I was on a call with them three times yesterday, and they obviously don't get this either. So they are working through this currently with me to find out what the best option is and what the steps going forward is with this animal. Since then, we have reached out to a facility that is willing to take it should the CFIA deem that fit for the animal. But at this point in time, it is in our quarantine. We are maintaining him. He's eating. He's a wild animal, so he's not used to people. So we're keeping him under as little stress as possible. We're not overactive in the habitat or anything like that. We go in, we do our routine maintenance of cleaning, feeding, and water changing and stuff like that, monitoring, make sure he's okay. And then once we hear back from the CFIA, we can then proceed with steps for any further veterinary care, whether he needs to have rabies vaccinations, a body checkup, make sure everything's where it needs to be, maybe make sure there's no other illnesses or maybe some blood work and things like that before he actually gets moved on to his forever home. If he ends up finding out where he came from, and that's what the CFIA are trying to do, to see exactly where this container came from in the United States, Mexico area, that's where these guys are found, because some of these animals in certain areas are critically endangered. So obviously if this is an animal in that situation, we would rather get this animal back to where it came from. And that's what we're working on currently.
While Sandy Pines will be getting back to business as usual, mostly with native species, they remain committed to helping in any way they can with the resolution, whether that means a return to the wild or a safe new home.
Well, they said they had a nice big area for him with some trees in it, so he would be safe in there until they could figure out something. Some department of the government is going to have to be involved. And if he is being sent anywhere, we will have to get permits and jump through a lot of hoops. But we'll do our best for this little guy. But at least I know he's in a safe place. And he's under veterinary care.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about a TLTI council vote on tripling the temporary borrowing limit.
Thank you, Jesse. The Township of Leeds in the Thousand Islands is set to consider a bylaw that would increase its temporary borrowing limit from $1 million to $3 million at its Committee of the Whole meeting on Monday. The recommendation comes as part of an annual housekeeping requirement under the Municipal Act, which permits municipalities to borrow funds temporarily to manage cash flow needs until taxes and other revenues are collected. Staff says the proposed increase better reflects municipal standards and is prudent in light of the township's financial outlook and upcoming capital projects. While Council previously approved a $1 million borrowing limit for 2025 at its December meeting, staff is now recommending passage of a new bylaw that would repeal the earlier measure and raise the limit to $3 million. Based on the amount of the current tax levy and potential cash flow pressures in the future, staff are recommending to increase the temporary borrowing limit to $3 million should the need arise, the report states. According to staff, cash flow pressures can emerge in years with significant capital expenditures, particularly as major spending often occurs before the township collects the second half of annual taxes in September. With capital reserve funds expected to decline in the coming years before recovering, a higher temporary borrowing ceiling offers flexibility to manage those demands. The borrowing limit remains well below the upper threshold set by the Municipal Act. In the first 9 months of the year, municipalities can borrow up to 50% of their annual revenues, dropping to 25% after September 30th. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LJI reporter for YGK News, Owen Fullerton, about a generous donation from KGH Auxiliary to Kingston Health Sciences Centers.
Thank you, Dinah. Last week, Kingston General Hospital Auxiliary presented Kingston Health and Sciences Center with a donation of $314,650, contributing to a number of equipment purchases and education for members of staff. The donation will fund purchases of 4 NICU ventilators and 15 oncology treatments, with remaining funds helping to finance annual education funding for KHSC staff through the Millennium Bursary Fund, as well as subsidizing departmental programs to support elder life and critical care. Chelsea Reynolds, president of KGH Auxiliary, says the amount donated has reached back to pre-COVID levels after a few years of lower fundraising amounts due to restrictions on visitors within hospitals. She says it really cut off almost all ability to fundraise, although staff members tried to continue to support efforts. Reynolds says that in previous years, funds have been directed towards redevelopment projects, but with those on hold while awaiting provincial involvement, KGH Auxiliary decided to direct funds to areas where an immediate impact could be made. The funds from KGH Auxiliary come largely from sales at the on-site locations of the Auxiliary Cafe, the Lottery Booth, the Tuck Shop, and the Gift Shop, as well as programs like the Teddy Bear Campaign, where funds are always earmarked for pediatrics. This past year, the campaign accounted for $28,000, and the KGH Auxiliary Board decided where to direct the remaining funds, choosing to support efforts in pediatric care and oncology treatment. In a release from KHSC, President and CEO David Pecora expressed thanks to KGH Auxiliary and said their efforts make a big difference. Over the course of 120 years, the Auxiliary has contributed over $20 million from fundraising efforts.
And thank you to Owen Fullerton for that story. Now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about public concerns over a proposed subdivision in Bath.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. A number of Bath residents came forward to speak at this week's public meeting regarding a draft plan of a subdivision in Bath. The subdivision in question is part of a number of phases of construction in the area. The draft plan looks at a space located at the north end of Country Club Drive, north of Main Street, and west of Church Street in Bath. Council heard from residents as they voiced a number of concerns. The first to speak, Grant Lindsay, brought up the lack of parks.
With the shift in the type of housing geared more towards families and families with children, there is a distinct lack of parkland for these children. There's only one existing site in this entire community, and that's the only active parkland space where there's a swing set where you can take your child.
Resident Jeremy Horworth mentioned Caitlin's responsibility to provide park space.
It's my understanding that a developer has to put a certain amount of funds aside to provide parks or something. I've never seen that from Caitlin.
Another resident, Louise Sweet, spoke about the issue of the construction traffic.
The construction traffic that is currently happening up and down Country Club Drive. I know Caitlin is aware of it, and it's something that's a major concern for the number of people on Country Club.
Resident Nancy Trudell also mentioned the speed of construction traffic.
My biggest concern is the speed. With the construction vehicles, the tradesmen, even some homeowners pass my house, because now that there's children in the area, it's dangerous. It's way too fast.
A newer resident of Bath and former police officer in Kingston, Mr. Cuthbert, described the potential dangers resulting from these issues.
I'm a police officer, a retired police officer for 48 years. I see all the construction coming up Country Club that makes it into 10 and then carries on into 11, 12, and 13. With all due respect, the traffic is disgusting. The improper vehicles that are coming up, the construction vehicles are coming up, construction vehicles coming from other sites all the way up Country Club into this site and then going back. You know what? I think there's three children in phase 10. Okay. I don't know. They walk up and down the street. They walk way to the other end in order to join the playground, or their parents have to drive them down there. And I feel sorry for them. Can't go onto the golf course. They either play in the streets where all this construction traffic is. Someone's going to get hurt.
Resident Sid Dick spoke about the golf course's driving range being relocated.
They also, when I bought 7 years ago, showed us a golf course that had a driving range and all the other amenities that go with a golf course. And it's my understanding that the driving range now is to be relocated. And that changes the project that I was presented and the representation that was made to me when I bought my unit. They're representing things to people to buy, and they're not living up to what they're saying. They're changing to maximize their opportunities.
Loyalist Township's planning supervisor, James Griffin, detailed how parkland is being factored into the proposal.
In terms of this application, what is being proposed is cash in lieu of parkland. So the Planning Act requires 5% of land be dedicated for parkland. If 5% of the land isn't dedicated, then we get a cash in lieu payment. In terms of the existing parkland for Loyalist Estates, so Loyalist Estates is somewhat of a unique subdivision in that it was given draft approval in the 1990s from the province of Ontario without an expiration date. So it never expired. And at that time, they did provide parkland for the two phases that were the original phases, the north and the south, along County Road 7 or Church Street and Abbeydon.
Griffin addressed concerns about construction traffic as well.
Just in terms of construction traffic, we understand and we hear that. In terms of the haul routes, so for the existing haul routes are there for the existing developments. In terms of this development, ultimately Phase 12, which is the connector from one end of Country Club to the other end of Country Club, it needs to be completed because we need the water services to be looped to the other end of Country Club in order to service Phase 14. So ultimately, that would be completed before Phase 14 would continue, or at least the not fully completed, but a pre-servicing agreement would be entered into and the services and the road would be constructed.
A recommendation will be brought forward to council once comments from township departments, agencies, and the public have been fully addressed. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about the search for a new CEO for Community Care Northumberland.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. 2026 will see new leadership at Community Care Northumberland as Trish Baird, CEO of the nonprofit for the past 36 years, is retiring. The idea of passing the torch has been on Baird's mind for a while. While she has been instrumental in growing this organization, she says she is excited about its future.
I kind of felt the same way, you know, at 20 years, at 25, at 30. Why am I staying here? But, I mean, I love my job. But the main reason is our organization. It's great to work here, especially with all of the volunteers and the employees. We all have kind of that similar value system, and it's perfect to be able to work in that environment and enjoy working with those people. So there's, you know, you never have a dull day, and I figure I'm here in my own, I live in my own community, I can help out my own community, so it's been great in that sense.
So let's talk about the beginnings. 12 employees, approximately 100 volunteers, now it's 100 employees and 500 volunteers.
Yeah.
How are you successful in making that grow?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people along the way, and I guess I've just been able to lead them on. Certainly, when I first started here, the types of services that were provided were fairly new in helping people in communities. So it was, you know, those isolated seniors, let's get them out. Meals on Wheels was running in the community by volunteers and other organizations. But a lot of volunteers worked to get seniors out of their homes that were isolated, and to have social and check-ins with them. So that was kind of how community care started, was in those fledgling organizations across Northumberland County, and the government started to help fund that. So I think through the realization that this helped people stay at home, stay well, prevented disease, prevented, you know, hospitalization, the more and more funding was added to that, and more recognition that supports such as, you know, helping people get to medical appointments through transportation, or helping them with personal distress alarms in their home, that as an aging population, those needs just grew and grew. So we certainly grew as our funding and supports were available, but it was never 100% funding. It always started in the day. It was, I think, 70% funding from the government, and we always had to fundraise, and clients had to pay for some of those services that had fees to them. So without that support and that extra money and fundraising, we wouldn't have been able to grow that way. But we also, you know, they also brought in programs that were maybe on their own. So, for example, like in Port Hope, the Red Cross ran the Meals on Wheels in Port Hope, and we were able to bring that into to community care and to provide, you know, be that multi-service organization that's able to cover the full county. And as awareness grew and our aging population grew, that's how, you know, we became what we are today. Now, certainly a big part of that is our hospice services. And in 2010, there was what's called an integration where hospice services or community hospice services joined Community Care Northumberland. So that was kind of new into our world. And certainly it, the recognition of hospice services is now, you know, there's lots more money being put into hospice residences, and we built Ed's House, but we also have received a lot, not a lot, but funding for grief and bereavement support. So, you know, it's kind of been able to grow in a recognition of the importance of those community supports.
So let's talk about the decision to retire. How did you come to that decision, and how do you feel about it?
Well, I mean, it's been rolling around in my brain for a while, and certainly, you know, it's kind of when's the right time to retire? And I think when you start thinking those things, that's probably the time to retire. I think I've kind of done what I can do at Community Care. I'm looking forward to whoever takes on this role to help move it forward into whatever that will be in the future. I have a grandson, you know, a young grandson, and another one on the way, so looking forward to spending time with them. And, you know, the board, I certainly do not want my transition to, I want my transition to be smooth. So I've given, the board has known about this, and I want to make sure that I can dump my knowledge from my head into somebody else. And so there's lots of time to do that transition.
What do you think you're going to miss most about this job and maybe helping the community?
I mean, I probably seeing the people that I either work or see as clients or volunteers. I mean, everyone's very lovely and fun to work with. So I will miss, you know, seeing those people. I'm not sure. Maybe ask me, you know, in next July, what do I miss most of community care? But yeah, I wouldn't be here unless I enjoyed what I did. But I think I'm at the time when I know it's time for somebody else to do it. So yeah, I will still live here in our community. I live in Campbellford, so you know, I get to still see lots of people every day that I not only work with but volunteer with in the community, so that won't stop.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, July 10th, daytime high of 24 degrees, a 90% chance of precipitation. It's going to be warm and humid here in the city of Kingston. Friday, July 11th, daytime high of 25, feeling closer to 31 thanks to the high humidity. Saturday, July 12th, a high of 25. It's going to be a beautiful sunny day, perfect start to your weekend. Sunday, July 13th, daytime high of 25, cloudy all day with some light cloud coverage into the afternoon. And then starting off next week, Monday, July 14th, 27 degrees, high UV index, lots of sun in the forecast.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
Saturday mornings. Whether you're waking up in a stranger's apartment or enjoying some time with the family, you need a nutritional breakfast for your ears. So join me, DJ Over Easy, for Makin' Bacon every Saturday morning from 8 until 10 on CFRC 101.9 and CFRC.ca.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Cataraqui on Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee land.
Sangi la.
Kwei.
Wai e beat nak seal.
Tan she.
Tanet e. Negat dakote.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Wai isquis sumakut kintilsin pinkton. I'm Tracy Kim Bono, and I'm coming to you from the Penticton Indian Reserve in British Columbia. I'm a storyteller, filmmaker, and most importantly, a grandmother. Fluent speakers have shared with me that our language, a sacred gift from the land and animals, embodies something profound. Our Tsleil-Waututh language transcends more than words. It conveys meaning, like vivid pictures. For thousands of years, it thrived solely as an oral tradition. However, in the late 70s, a passionate group of Tsleil people took upon themselves a remarkable challenge of creating an alphabet. Among them is Dr. Maxine Baptiste, a true inspiration. Having known Maxine for over 30 years, I see her as one of my Tsleil-Waututh language heroes. That's why I wanted to sit down with her and discover how it all began.
It started with my sister, Bernice. She had applied to UVic for, it was called the BC Indian Language Project. And that project was to teach community members in all the languages in BC to learn how to write, read and write their language. And like the different disciplines, like morphology, phonology, syntax, and semantics. And she encouraged me to apply, and I applied and I went, but at that time my funding never came in. I was there for 6 weeks, and it was so interesting because they did five languages in the classroom. Okanagan was one of them. I stayed in the same apartment as my sister, and I had my two babies. They were two and one, and nothing came in. I had no funding. I had no money. I kept phoning and saying, well, when's my money coming in? And they said, and I kept borrowing money to pay for the babysitter, to get a bus pass. And so I phoned my husband and I said, we need at least $200 to get through until I get my check. And he said, I'll send you $200, but you come home. So I cried and I carried on, and but I went home, and it took me another, that was in 1978, and it took me another 10 years before I went back to school. I just, that was like a really big letdown for me, because learning about languages and linguistics was so interesting. And then when I had to go home, I was so disappointed. And I just stayed home, and I was a stay-at-home mom, and I looked after my babies. And it wasn't until 1985 my sister came and got me. She said, there's a workshop I want you to come to. And I was very introverted, and I said, I don't want to go. And she said, you're coming. I said, no, I'm not. I'm staying home. I said, who's going to look after my baby? She said, I'll find someone to look after them, but you're coming. So I said, okay. So I went, and it was a 3-day workshop 1985 with a room full of elders, Tony Matina, Dave Parker, Herbie Manuel, my sister, and Herman. They were all there to showcase how they wrote the language. And the elders were there to decide which writing system that they would choose to write Okanagan. So every day, and the room was full of elders. There must have been about 30 elders in that workshop. And Glenn Douglas was the facilitator. And they would, all of them showcased how they wrote the language and why they spelt things this way and what sort of letters they used. So they chose the International Phonetic Alphabet on that time.
This was a groundbreaking moment for our language recovery, and Maxine realized there was work to be done. Her first task was to learn how to use a customized typewriter that had been modified with a specialized golf ball featuring characters from the International Phonetic Alphabet. When I graduated in 1985, personal computers were just being introduced to the world. As computers advanced, so did the language. The phonetic system advanced, but it was a challenge. As technology advanced in the mid-1980s, Maxine was introduced to computers. This marked the beginning of a new learning curve, particularly in understanding which font systems would be compatible with the Inciltian alphabet. After much trial and error, Unicode was the answer, which was developed in the early 1990s. It solved many of the problems that were associated with the typewriters and special phonetics that were limited with the alphabet ball.
Well, when we first did the Okanagan alphabet, all we had was a typewriter. So the symbol for the gamma, it wasn't available. So we used a written Y. And some the language learners get confused. They say that's not that, because it's a sound. It's like ligamin, so or gapen. And then they would say, no, that's a Y. It has to be yeepen. And I say, no, you can't say yeepen for gapen. You have to put it's a gamma sound. But the only issue is we didn't have a gamma to put there. So that was starting to confuse language learners. They didn't want to say the "the." They wanted to say the "y" sound.
So how do you say this?
It's a rapin.
Rapin?
Rapin.
Rapin?
It's a rap. The rap. It's a rap. Yeah.
That's the gamma.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was the only confusion for some language learners, because I guess it's hard for them to say a gamma. But
so what is the alphabet? It's a phonetic system.
The International Phonetic Alphabet. The premise is it's one sound, one symbol. So some fluent speakers can pick it up really fast because they speak the language. So if I tell them this word says Canucks, or this word says Weekenchin, or this word says acht, then I tell them that the Bard Lambda says a k.
Oh, okay.
And then A, and then the wedge X. Acht.
It was truly an aha moment for me as I practiced the sounds of the language. I became aware of how incredibly complex pronunciation is and understood why fluent speakers emphasize its importance for language learners. I realized that the new writing system could help identify the correct pronunciation of words. The next significant challenge was to develop lesson plans that would promote fluency while navigating a colonial education system that lacked experts, aside from my nation's fluent speakers.
From 87 to 1990, we had a room full of elders that would help, because at that same time, we started getting the language. They were negotiating with the language to be put in the public schools, and the BC College of Teachers said they had to have a language authority to certify fluent speakers as fluent speakers. Then they could go into the classroom to teach the language. But the caveat to that was they had to have a certified teacher in the classroom at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that's how we got a lot of our elders into the public schools. And then as a consequence of that, there was a lot of, there was no curriculum for Okanagan language.
Yeah.
So we had to do all the materials and resources and testing. And so we would get together and get the elders together and have them name things that we didn't have names for, like a computer or a typewriter or a stapler or different kinds of things that the language teachers would use in the classroom. So we started making lists of words and starting to build curriculum, starting to put materials and resources together for the language teachers, and we did have a room full of elders that helped us.
How long have you been doing this? 30, 40 years?
I was at an Ankara in 1987 to do my grade 12, and I never really left.
So we're talking decades.
Yeah, well, I went, I finished my school, and then Don Fitter asked me if I would be the librarian, and I said, yeah, I can do that. So that's what I did. Like, when I went in the library, most of the books were all in boxes. So it took us 2 years to put everything on the shelf, everything labeled, everything with a number, everything in the computer. And then we had those little cards that we had to put the information of each book, and we had those filing systems for those little cards. And I got the books done, I got the magazines done, I got the newspapers done, and I sat there and I said, okay, now what do I do? And people would come in, and I'd follow them. And I'd say, what do you need? What kind of research are you doing? What kind of book do you want? I'm just looking. And I'd be behind them, and I said, okay, this is not what I want to do. So I decided to apply to university. Well, Tony was the one that told me, because every time he'd come up, I would follow him. Why does this word do that? Why is this word spelled this way? And then when other things are added to it, it changes the meaning, and other things are added to it, it changes again. So he said, you really need to go to linguistics. And I said, but I have to leave home. And that one summer he said, you're just going to have to bite the bullet and go. In order for me to stay home and to keep taking courses, I took almost every course at OK College. And then when I went to UVic to do my bachelor's, they looked at my 3 pages of courses I took, and they said, you only need your linguistics courses to do a BA. So I was only there for 3 semesters, and I finished my BA. And then I went to do my master's at University of BC in Vancouver. And then I came home. I didn't have anything, like, I didn't have no work. I was out of school. So my husband said, you have to work. I said, I know. So I went in the vineyard, and that's where your mom phoned me. She said, where are you at? I ran into her somewhere in a store. She said, what are you doing? Are you done? I said, yeah. She said, where are you at? I said, I'm working in the vineyard. You have a master's degree and you're working in a vineyard. I said, it's money. My husband said, I have to work. You come and work with me and you teach at Nauken. And that's when I started teaching. And I took another hiatus. I went to University of Arizona in Tucson to do my PhD, and that was 3 years. And I came back in 2007, and I've been here ever since.
So what does a linguist learn?
We learn syntax, which is the study of phrases and sentences in a language. Morphology looks at the pieces of words that are put together to make a word. Phonology looks at the sound system. Okay. What happens when you put 2 sounds together?
Okay.
Not all languages have the same sounds.
Okay.
Because every language has their own sound system. Phonetics looks like how would you represent those sounds on paper. And semantics looks at meaning. And I also looked at comparative and historical linguistics. And I like that discipline because it goes back to what you call a proto-language. There's one proto-language that was maybe 15,000 years ago, mm-hmm. and for some reason all these languages branched out from it. Mm-hmm. So the Salishan language has 27 languages, mm-hmm. and it's divided between coastal Salish and interior Salish. Okay. So the interior Salish is divided between north and south. Okay. In BC, there's Lillooet, Thompson, Shuswap, and Okanagan as northern interior Salish. Across the border, it's the Coeur d'Alene, Kalispell, Flathead, Spokane, Ponderay, Metow, Moses Columbian, and Chelan. I think that's all. That's the southern interior Salish. Mm-hmm. And they're mutually intelligible. I can understand when some people speak their language, like at the language conference they have down there. I can understand them. If you look at the neighboring languages, Lillooet has and Thompson have Zeds in their language, but that's a result of the coastal Salish have Zeds and Gs. We don't have Gs, we don't have Zeds.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that you can tell when there's a neighboring language, they kind of borrow from that yeah. language.
So, yeah, I've heard that said, I guess, really basic Nux Chin, like we all mm-hmm. had one mm-hmm. language.
Yeah.
And then that really explains to me, now I understand how it branched out into the different language families, because yeah. I've been in Squamish before, and I've heard words that we use are mm-hmm. similar. Mm-hmm. So that yeah. really makes sense. So yeah. that must have been fascinating.
Yeah, yeah, that's what comparative historical languages do. It looks at what they call cognates. So how does the language say the word eat across all these 15 languages? Yeah. And then they begin to change. Then why does it change from this and at the last 15th language has a total different word? So how did that change from here to here?
Yeah.
So that's what comparative historical linguistics looks at.
That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. And somebody with your knowledge and background of community probably really adds to those studies and really enriches those studies and makes them better, because when you learn that, you also put what you've learned from your community.
I asked Maxine for a bit of a language lesson. I wanted to see if I could figure out what some of the sounds sounded like based on what it looked like on paper. But she jumped right into the sounds.
Okay, so this one is called the Bard L.
Bard L?
Yeah. And that one, when you say that sound, you put your tongue, there's a hard ridge behind your teeth.
Okay.
And that's called the alveolar ridge. You put your tongue there,
yeah.
and you blow the air out over the sides.
Okay.
Go. And that's the sound where you say human.
Human.
Kakcha.
Kakcha.
Sisach.
Sisach.
Seens.
Seens.
Yeah, that's
okay.
the sound.
Did I do it?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And another one?
And this one is a glottalized T. And that one is... You say t'ina.
T'ina.
T'lep.
Oh, okay, that's hard. Hang on a second.
T'lep, it means t'lep. To tear.
Okay, t'lep. What is this one?
This one is a glottalized Q. Q's are said farther back in your mouth. A K is said almost in the middle, like you say kielch, but kiel. A Q is said farther back. It's a k, 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 k.
But oh, this, I see.
But this one is a glottalized Q. It's a k, k.
That's so technical.
Yeah, so this one is k-achen.
K-achen. K-achen.
K-achen. K'achen.
K'achen. Yeah. Did I do that right?
Yeah. K'achen.
K'achen.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do one with a flying W and explain what a flying W is.
A flying W, it rounds your mouth when you say the sounds. A regular K is just a K. K. You say Kielch.
Kielch.
But then when you put a raised W beside it, it's quint. You round your mouth. Quint.
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 Yeah.
Okay. So in that word, Tim Hula, mm-hmm. is that why you do that at the end? Mm-hmm. Tim Hula.
Yeah, there's two X raised W.
Okay.
Tim Hula.
Tim Hula.
Yeah.
Okay. And what about this one?
It's a glottalized raised W. It's this one is this one is
oh, that's why you have that's hard. You have to put them two together.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We'll do one of these and then, we'll finish our interview.
Pharyngeal, they call that a backward correction, a question mark. And that was it's down here, near close to your Adam's apple. It's
So it's like when you're joking around,
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Eitman.
I'm
Ian Chut.
Ian Chut.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So you have to say that.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is that?
That one is a glottalized pharyngeal, and that emphasizes the ah. It's a clamming. It goes deeper.
Okay.
Clamming. Yeah, it goes way deeper.
Clamming.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that's just eitmen, and this is klamin.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so in asking about this, why is it important that words are pronounced properly? Because I'm looking at this and I'm beginning to understand the importance of pronunciation and not missing those
little sounds. Because if you take one diacritic, like a glottal stop or a glottalization mark, if you take that away, then that's going to change the meaning of the word.
Okay.
So if you say k-eight, it means rain. Let's see. But if you say k-eight, you glottalize the T, that's a fish hook.
Oh.
Yeah.
So it's so close.
Yeah, yeah.
So I want to hear the difference again.
K-eight. You glottalize the K, but not the T.
Great.
Eight. And then you say eight.
Eight.
Yeah, then that means a fish hook.
Oh, so that's why the pronunciation is important, because you could be saying I'm standing in a fish hook instead of standing in the rain.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like when this lady was saying, she said, I would come in the morning and I'm learning my language and I'd be so happy to speak my language at any time I have a chance to. And I'd come in and I'd say, chast, kwekwatst. And the mentor was sitting there and he goes, say that again. And she said, chast, kwekwatst. And he said, what time is it? She said, it's a morning. He said, you're saying good evening. You're supposed to say chast, kwekwatst.
Oh, and that's that.
Yeah.
Chast, kwekwatst. And that's the difference.
Yeah.
Between saying good morning and good night.
Yeah.
So do you speak the language?
I speak the language, but I'm considered more of a silent speaker.
Okay.
Because I used to sit and listen to my mom and dad speak all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened, like, my sister Bernice and my three older brothers, they never spoke English till they went to school.
Mm-hmm.
And the priest came and told my mom, don't talk Okanagan to Esther and Maxine.
Okay.
Because when they go to school, it'll be too hard on them. So she stopped speaking the language to us. And my dad was mad at her but he wouldn't stop speaking the language to us. He would talk to us, like give us directions, like we're going to go get water, or we're going to pack in some wood, or you can watch me making bread. So he talked to us in the language, but my mom refused. So I would... Then there was all these elders that used to come over to my mom and dad's house, and we had coal oil lamps and we had wood stoves, and they would blow the coal oil lamp out so they would preserve the oil, and then they would just sit there by the firelight and they would drink tea and eat fruit and snacks all night long, and they would talk Okanagan and tell stories and talk about all sorts of different things. And I used to lay beside my mother on a quilt. I'd bring my quilt out there and I'd wrap up and I'd lay beside her and I'd listen, and I'd wake up and I'd be in my bed, and mm-hmm. they'd be still visiting, and I'd say, who put me in my bed? So I'd go back, but morning I'd be in my bed again. Mm-hmm. But I always listened to them. So I heard a lot of language, but I could understand them, but it's speaking that's hard for me to do. Mm-hmm. It's really kind of difficult for me to talk. I speak with people that I really trust, mm-hmm. but I don't speak out.
You're doing a lot of, you've done so much. Mm-hmm. What do you want to continue doing? What is your hopes for the work that you're, what do you see in the future?
What I really wanted to do was to continue documenting fluent speakers, because all of our, most of our fluent speakers are in their 80s, and then the younger ones are in their 70s. We don't have very many that are in their 60s. And the ones that hold the high language are mm-hmm. in their 80s. So it's important to document them as much as possible, because the language learners that are learning the language, they're learning a more simpler language. And if we lose that high fluency, then that's all they'll be able to speak, unless we have the audio that they can refer to learn higher language, more fluent language than what they have now, because it's really important to me, because every year our fluent speakers are getting less, mm-hmm. lesser and lesser.
Throughout this country, I've heard many nations express concern about the dwindling time that we have with our fluent speakers. When Dr. Baptiste embarked on this journey, she made significant sacrifices and shared with me that despite the challenges that sometimes prevented her from pursuing her passion, she found a way to continue. I am truly amazed by how she navigated the transition from typewriters to computers. One thing is clear. Dr. Maxine Baptiste has made our world a better place for the Sealh people to regain our language and identity. Thanks for listening with me on this episode of Words and Culture. Isguist sumachatk. Until next time, ninumlich achacha guquakwalt.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Audio recording by Craig Carpenter. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Hausin Dang King Sam.
Maltus.
Ninuis Achacha Miku Kwakwal.
Kachunautano.
Wapamatin Mina.
I'm being completely honest now, okay? Homelessness makes me uncomfortable. But then I think, at least it's not sleeping on the sidewalk with everything I own uncomfortable.
Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
Did you know that New Leaf Link offers day programming for adults with developmental disabilities? We serve families in Kingston and South Frontenac. Our program focuses on arts, healthy living, and community connections, including summer camp. New Leaf Link's caring staff and talented instructors provide a place for everyone to learn together and build friendships. If you or someone you know would like to join our program, please visit newleaflink.ca for more details. Together, we can grow, connect, and belong.
Your true, true friend loves you just as you are.
KPP Concerts has a stacked lineup of all-ages concerts happening at the Broom Factory through this summer into early fall. On June 27th, check out Housewife, followed by Friday's Child at the Broom Factory on July 11th. Then on August 10th, enjoy music from hip-hop artist Matt Mac, followed later by The Dirty Nil on September 19th. Then on September 26th, it's Petite Belle Yvonne and neo-grunge icons The Bridge City Sinners coming to town on September 27th. And then Yukon Blonde gets us into the fall spirit on September 28th. All shows are all ages at the Broom Factory and co-presented by CFRC 101.9 FM. For a complete list of shows and ticket information, visit kppconcerts.com.
Guys, gals, non-binary pals, different circles is moving. Same day,